From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Nolan.
They call me Ben. You are you, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. As always, we are joined with our super producer, Tristan McNeil.
Has it always been like that?
Rejoined.
Rejoined.
Is this like a Mandela effect thing?
That's exactly what it is.
Time is a flat circle.
Weird.
Hey, I have a question. We have talked about this off air at length, but it's a question I always love to ask people. If you could have three superpowers, what would they be? And here's why it's three instead of one.
Okay.
Most people choose flying.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't even think, like, are you flying, you know, using some sort of psychic power, some sort of telekinesis? Or
teleporting is clearly better than flying.
I think so, but for some people it's about the journey.
But then do you also have to have magical breathing powers so that you can go to high altitudes and not, like, suffocate and die?
Yeah, and what happens if you go too fast and you hit something in the air, you know? Nobody wants to go out by a rude run-in with a seagull. But anyway, yeah, there are things to consider.
So invisibility is always the one I go to. Super strength and some kind of Superman-like invulnerability.
Invisibility is like the way it's portrayed in like the Lord of the Rings. It's practically a godlike power.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Precisely.
You can totally manipulate events if you're invisible.
Yeah, and you'd also want to be invisible to electronic surveillance methods as well, right?
Mm-hmm. You know. So maybe just all three are invisible to certain spectrums.
There we go. Yeah. I would want to be invulnerable. I'd want to be able to teleport, and I'd like to have some sort of shadow power.
Wow. Like, we're making superheroes.
Can you be more specific?
About my shadow powers?
I mean, shadow powers are pretty obvious. You can manipulate any and all dark.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. That's it. What about you, Noel?
Oh, man. You guys are putting me on the spot. I mean, I think teleportation would be really, really cool.
Yeah.
Because I hate the airport.
Well, are we talking like Nightcrawler that can teleport to something he can see?
Don't make me embarrass myself. So he can teleport up to like 2 miles. And he can bring other people with him,
but it's a physical strain. I need more than 2 miles. If I'm gonna cut out the airport, I need to be able to blip myself to New York or LA.
And I like
or Fiji.
Yeah, and I like the one thing that you probably also want is you want some sort of instinctual inability to teleport yourself into objects.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, being able to see something is pretty important and know at least.
This is like some monkey's paw business here. We really have to, like, think out all the ramifications of these superpowers. So I'm going to stick with that. So it's almost like my other two powers have to be stuff to mitigate any, like, fallout
yes.
from the teleportation.
Yeah, you don't want to accidentally all of a sudden become stucco. You know?
Or you just end up like in a pillar, a concrete pillar, and you just suffocate to death.
And you got one arm hanging out.
But couldn't you just suck?
And that's the story of me.
No. Would you use Blip as your superhero name?
I like Blip.
I think it's cool, especially if that's the sound you make.
And I'll wear like a cool 80s like backwards hat and like some hyper-color clothes, you know? Game Boy. I'm kind of mixing my eras here.
I think this is a great conversation. We want to hear what your three powers would be as well. One of the things that we love on this show, and I'm sure you can tell, is we love superheroes, supervillains, and usually one of the reasons that these heroes or villains are so extraordinary is because they have an extraordinary power or powers that are unique to them as an individual. And this is an old idea. It didn't just start with comic books.
Oh yeah, this goes back to antiquity. We're talking about the belief in a human having some kind of ability beyond what would be considered normal. We're talking about superhuman strength, precognition, some kind of stamina that's extraordinary, or even durability, being able to live forever and having immortality, or even commune with certain types of animals.
Or just maybe having a really pungent odor.
That's probably true.
But one of the biggest ones that we've talked about before is being able to transmute a metal or one object into another type of object.
Sure. Lead to gold, water to wine, all the hits, all the big ones. And don't think we let you slip past, Matt. By the end of the show, we're going to have to figure out what your superhero or supervillain name is.
Okay, no worries.
Okay. It's fair that I'll have to do the same thing. And then together we'll nominate something for Tristan. Sorry, Tristan, you don't get a vote. All right. So often these powers that Matt mentions would come from either interaction with a god or being the descendant of a god. You know, that's so much mythology is lousy with half human, half god creatures, right?
The old demigods.
Mm-hmm. And these abilities could also be some part of a curse, you know?
Yeah, you get something good. And on the other hand, oh, there's awful things happening in your life.
Here are some examples featured in this clip from the 2016 movie Gods of Egypt.
Ages have passed since the gods walked among us.
Only one god can save us, but not without his eyes.
We need your help.
Soon I will rule all of the world.
So how do we stop him? Try to keep up.
You know what's waiting. Set has an army behind him. Gods, beasts, demons.
We should run.
Run?
We mortals do it all the time.
What is it?
It's a fictional world where every important person in Egypt is white.
Yeah, that's the main superpower, is the superpower of whiteness.
Oh, boy.
No, but it's like, it's this total Michael Bay, dumb blockbuster, kind of like Transformers-y looking thing featuring all of these gods from, you know, the mythology of Egypt, like
Horus and
all that stuff, and like, but it's just blisteringly dumb.
And they treat like superheroes, right?
Treat like superheroes. Yeah. Everything about it, yeah, just big, lots of like bullet time, you know, slow-mo, 300 kind of stuff. And I don't know. I didn't want to derail this too much, but I just think that's a funny example of like kind of like how would we modernize these ideas of superpowers from the past into like a really dumb example of like modern superhero movies. And this is it.
That's spot on. I think that's a great example. It's a good argument too, because as cultures and civilizations evolve, stories of these similar powers persisted, but they're increasingly acknowledged to be works of fiction, right? And the cause of the power also evolves. You know, we have radioactive spiders and chemical spills instead of gods banging our moms.
Well, totally. It's like a way of like making peace or like wrapping your head around some phenomenon that's tied to like the current time or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like
absolutely.
Some social norm or some like environmental distressing thing, you know, like, like again, like radioactivity, you know, nuclear war, a lot of like, the early superheroes, like in Marvel and DC, even like Captain America and stuff were tied to like fear of like an enemy, like an unseen, you know, like Nazis and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of this goes back to man's want to be exceptional in some way.
To dominate, right?
Yeah, to dominate and just be cool, man.
Harder, faster, stronger, smarter, right?
Yeah.
And that's what this episode is about. So I think we did an all right job with a brief look at superpowers and heroism and how it evolves with culture. But here's the thing. They're real life superpowers.
No.
Yes. They're real life superpowers, and as we record this, there are not only people who have these abilities that we will explore and we'll give you some examples, but there are groups and organizations seeking to exploit or privatize or somehow profit from these abilities.
That is wow.
I know. It sounds like we just wrote this really cool Netflix original sci-fi thing.
Yeah.
But
isn't that a thing? Isn't there like a...
Is there already one?
Well, it makes me think of that show, Misfits.
Oh, yeah, Misfits.
It was on the BBC where this is no spoilers, but, you know, these youngish
delinquents
are imbued with pretty cool, unique powers based on some sort of electrical storm or something like
that.
Yeah,
there's a big
storm. But they have to kind of like figure out how to like work their lives around these abilities because some of them are very debilitating and like, you know, cause real problems.
They're not
like,
all
you know,
great.
Relationships and stuff.
I will give just for an example. I'm really glad you mentioned that show. Just for an example of the range of these powers, there are people who can, manipulate things telekinetically, but only dairy products. There's one guy who does that.
It's scientifically.
IRL?
Yes.
No. On Misfits.
Is that true?
Maybe okay. IRL. Maybe there's.
Whoa, I didn't know that. That's a pretty weak superpower. What would you do? Like, just douse people with rotten milk?
I don't know, man. Wait for someone to drink milk and then be like, you're in my world now.
And if the milk turns, do you lose your control over it?
That's a good point, man. That's the dark side. So here then are some examples of real life superpowers. Longtime listeners, you may recognize this from a video we had done in the past. You may have heard some of these in other sources, but unless you're a very specific type of researcher, you probably haven't heard all of these. The first one is echolocation, human echolocation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the ability to sense objects around you by hearing the echoes that are produced from a sound, usually that you produce.
Isn't that the dolphin sound, though, that they do, like when they use
echolocation? Bats do the same kind of thing where they're sending out a signal and they're just listening to what's being reflected.
And this could be replicated by humans, for example, through tapping of a cane or stomping a foot, snapping the fingers, making clicking noises with one's mouth.
Yeah, it's used a lot in people who lack sight or have visual problems.
And not to be crass, but this is like real life Daredevil stuff, you know, without the superhuman enhanced other senses, right? But echolocation was coined by this zoologist named Donald Griffin back in 1944. However, the reports of people who lack sight being able to locate these objects goes back to 1749. Silent objects, not like playing Marco Polo with someone in a pool or something, but you know, being able to know that this bottle of mineral water is this far away, you know.
I mean, it's almost like the audio equivalent of like tracking a scent, right?
Where
it's
there we go.
You send something out and then you can determine how far it is based on like how quickly it bounces back or something like that. You follow a trail. You can kind of like fill in the distance, I guess.
Yeah. And since the 50s, people have been researching this in human beings, right? This learned echolocation. We don't know for sure if someone was born blind, if they would naturally learn it on their own. We don't know if that's, you know, like the overwhelming majority of infants are all born knowing how to swim, right?
Yeah.
Which is still – that's a weird thing.
And then they lose it.
Yeah, and then they lose
somehow,
it.
Somehow. Right? Because, I had to teach my kid to swim, so obviously that didn't stick. If only they were born learning how to – knowing how to ride a bike, that'd be cool.
Yeah, right? That's the one.
Yeah.
That's the real hassle.
The craziest thing to me about this specific type of echolocation is that it's not all the ears. Your ears are not doing all the work. It's also the skin, right?
The skin. So they used to believe for a long time that you, if you were practicing echolocation, you would feel pressure changes nearby objects. And this is something, this sense of proximity is something that a lot of people report in various different ways. Like, do you believe that you can feel when someone's looking at you? Right from behind.
Feel like I feel it.
Yeah.
Do I?
I don't. That's another. That's a question. Are we only remembering the times that we turn around and there is someone there? Because I usually.
We should Pepsi challenge that sometime.
We should definitely do that. How do we test that? Do we just tell our coworkers?
Well, it's like that scene in Ghostbusters, you know, where he like holds up the cards and gives them a shock when they get it wrong or whatever. You know.
Have you guys ever tried walking down our massive hallway to the elevators and closing your eyes?
Yes.
I've tried to do that before, and you really can sense when you're getting close to a wall. It's really interesting. But that is all the ears.
But it also makes sense because you would detect a change in the airflow, I would think. You know, as it butts up against a surface.
There we go.
If you felt like a wide hallway as you got closer to a wall, I would think you would definitely detect a sense of like – a change in space, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a really solid argument. One of the most famous cases of this in recent times is a fellow named Ben Underwood. He was diagnosed with retinal cancer at the age of 2, and at the age of 3, he had to have his eyes removed. And then he learned with the help of a mentor to detect the location of objects by making clicking noises with his tongue. And with this ability, he was able to run, play basketball, ride a bicycle, rollerblade, play football, skateboarding. These are, mm-hmm. you know, using dynamic, quote unquote, silent objects, you know?
Yeah. Is very much two things. It's very much Daredevil to me because he had this mentor that was teaching him how to do this, right? And the other thing is you can see Ben Underwood doing these things by searching the internet for him. You can see him.
And also, one thing that's interesting is this is one of the talents that apparently can be taught to anyone with okay hearing.
Wow.
So we could all learn to practice echolocation.
Is there a YouTube video? Can I learn it?
I wonder. You know, there should be.
Or do I need like a mentor? Sensei? Yeah.
You probably need a lot of experiential practice, you know.
I'm not doing it then.
You're not going to do it. You're at that stage in life where you're like, I'll just make friends with someone.
If I can't learn to do it by watching one, at most, a series of three YouTube videos, I'm not interested.
Oh, wow.
That's sad.
There's another thing that gets grouped in with superpowers that we definitely should mention, but we should also point out that this could be its own episode, and it's the idea of intellectual superpowers, mm-hmm. geniuses,
yeah.
savant syndrome. You know, a genius, as we know, is a person who has an exceptional intellectual ability or originality, or they're super prolific, typically to a degree that is associated with new advances in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't just build a better mousetrap. They like change the way we think of mice and traps.
Yeah.
And it's neat because a lot of times in comics and stuff, the ones that have this superpower tend to be super villains, right?
Yeah, right.
They're
right.
too smart for their
like
own
Ozymandias,
good.
I mean, Watchmen, he had some super strength stuff going on, but he was also like super techie minded and could mm-hmm. like, you know, come up with all this crazy stuff. But then a lot of times there's like an antithesis to that on the good side too.
Yeah.
Sure, but they're flawed. There's no like perfect person who's also very smart as a superpower. They're Dr. Doom level crazy mm-hmm. or Ozymandias crazy, or they have, you know, like crippling alcoholism like Tony Stark and some major father issues.
He's gotten his stuff together in the more recent movies.
It's true. So one thing that's fascinating here as well is that despite all the self-professed and the self-professed geniuses and all the other people who say so-and-so is a genius, most geniuses tend to concentrate in a single sort of discipline or activity. Now, there are Renaissance people around, mm-hmm. you know, who do multiple things, but it's much more common for someone to excel in a single intellectual pursuit. And so far throughout history, none of these geniuses have focused on finding a precise scientific definition of the word genius, because we also, it turns out, do a real shoddy job trying to define intelligence. So when we say someone's a genius, technically we don't really know what we're saying.
What's the vary? Is the word qualitative?
Yeah, instead
we're,
of
quantitative. We're instilling like an end result. We're saying John Lennon was a genius because he made Imagine, or like the Beatles were geniuses because they made this work that we find to be superb.
Right. We don't have any hard data, any quantitative thing. There's an argument that a genius needs to have at least a 125 IQ score, but the IQ test itself, as we know, is
flawed at best.
Yeah, flawed at best, like the last season of Lost.
Yeah. Tell me what you guys think about this.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
You mean the one where they were all dead?
Oh, my God. No, stop it.
Just kidding. That's not what happened. That's a callback. We got yelled at for spoiling the end mm-hmm. of Lost. And
somebody lost it.
Oh, that's good.
When I'm imagining geniuses here, I imagine that we're all D&D characters, and we all have a certain amount of points that we get to go, you know, we get to put into our character, right?
Yeah.
And in this instance, in reality, those points are actually time that we spend on things.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're rolling the dice, it's actually you spending time on things, and then you get better and better and better exponentially, perhaps, at one thing. Like we're saying, a genius a lot of times will focus on something
uh-huh.
or have a specific area.
Yeah, that's a good point. And speaking of focus, there's another side to this we mentioned when we talked about intellectual abilities, and that is something called savant syndrome, which is controversial, but is real.
Oh, it's very much real. And this is when someone demonstrates a profound ability, something that is objectively in – it exceeds what would be considered normal.
Somehow like innate, right? Like yeah. Almost like a predisposition towards a very specific skill set that like they have no business like based on experience.
Right.
Having.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's extra extraordinary because a lot of times people who have savant syndrome, or almost every time, there are defects in other areas of the brain or of development.
Well, the super non-PC term is idiot savant, right?
Right. That's the old term they would use. And it was used because they would say, well, here is a person who in many ways may not be able to function unassisted in society, but isn't it weird that they know what day of the week when September 17th, 2045 would be?
Is this like the Dustin Hoffman character in Rain Man?
Kind of
like a cliche example of this.
Mm-hmm. I think you're spot on. So as Matt said, these people who have savant syndrome may have neurodevelopmental disorders, even brain injuries. There's something called acquired savant syndrome, where someone sustains a traumatic brain injury and then emerges with, for instance, the ability to sketch with enormous proficiency, right? And I think Stuff You Should Know might have explored one or two of these sorts of cases. So do check that out. The most dramatic examples of savant syndrome occur with people who score very, very low on IQ tests while being inarguably brilliant in specific areas. And we do have to say, although it's called a syndrome, currently it's not recognized as a mental disorder or even part of a mental disorder in medical manuals. So what kind of stuff are they skilled at? What are these savant skills all about?
I mean, the most common type of savants are what's called calendrical savants or human calendars. And they are able to, like you were saying earlier, Ben, calculate the day of the week for any given date with a speed and accuracy that's pretty much uncanny. Or they can recall memories, very specific memories from any given date in time. That they're aware of.
So they can –
that they were alive. I mean, it's not like seeing the future. But
yeah. That would be cool.
That's another superpower entirely.
That's another – yeah. We don't have precognition on there. There's also a thing called hyperthymesia. This is people who have an extremely detailed autobiographical memory. This is different from savant syndrome. These people will have very, very detailed memories – and they don't have to try to remember them, you know, like a mentalist or someone doing a reciting pi trick. These people could, if they were reciting pi aloud just to themselves, and then, you know, they remembered that, oh, I was hanging with my buddies Ben and Noel, and that's why I remember these 800 digits of pi. You know, that's strange. You got to wonder how useful or not useful that is.
Is there a connection to like having a photographic memory in this?
I think it is. I think that's pretty much the same. The weird thing is it's tied to their associations. So they wouldn't just remember every page of a book they read. They would remember how they felt for every page and how much change was in their pocket. You know,
don't you think that would have the potential to like overwhelm you?
I think by the time you're in your like 40s, that's got to be a real hassle.
I would just be like, shut up. Yeah. Shut up, brain.
It reminds me of how Daniel Tammet, who there's this book called Born on a Blue Day. And I think he's got another one, Thinking in Numbers. It's somebody that my wife was really fascinated by, who can think – when he thinks about numbers, he sees a shape, like a physical shape.
Yeah, synesthesia.
Exactly.
Got that one coming up, right?
Yeah. And he combines that with, I guess, a photographic memory to be able to do extraordinary things with numbers.
So it also sort of grounds the memories in multiple sensory encodes, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, there's a day that is blue and is round.
Yeah.
Right? And maybe has a soft texture, a soft fuzzy texture.
Yeah. It's incredible.
And was it Tuesday?
Was it Tuesday? You are correct, sir. You are correct.
Should we pop into a quick break before we continue?
Yeah, let's get to the really weird stuff after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. And guys, let's jump right in to one of my favorites.
Your favorite? How many spoons can you stick to your body, Matt?
That's it. Magnetism.
Spoon is too big.
Magneto, man. I remember just being so excited by that as a kid when reading it in comic books. The idea of being able to take anything metal and manipulate it.
He came off as pretty godlike.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Especially in the movies when he's just like arms out, stretched, and just like stuff is like levitating, and then he crushes it down on
that
everyone.
That was so cool.
Really neat.
The only defense is to build your armor out of stone. I'm just kidding.
I like that. So, yeah. So human magnetism, or the human quote-unquote magnetos, it turns out, are not quite as not quite as powerful.
Extreme.
They're not lifting stadiums, but they are attracting objects to their bare skin.
Yeah, and they're human magnets.
Mm-hmm. That's the idea. One example would be Edebar Elchiev from the country of Georgia. He is a Guinness World Record holder for the most spoons on a human body.
There's too many spoons on my body.
It was 50 spoons. I guess he got to 51. Maybe he ran out of room.
Yeah.
And they told him he couldn't. Well, this is a family show.
But wasn't this
I could get way more than 50 spoons on my body. Okay.
Oh, well.
Yeah, because they don't say the size of the spoon. Is it a regulation spoon?
Wasn't this somehow debunked, though, by Mr. Randy?
I don't see. I don't think the use of the word debunked is appropriate. This is like explained. I know sometimes a lot of people who consider themselves like internet expert skeptics love to think that they're debunking stuff. It's like if you drive by a Blockbuster and it's closed, you didn't debunk Blockbuster. It's just not open.
Well, I guess, okay, so the right thing would be he showed that it wasn't actually magnetism that was going on.
Yeah, yeah. And some people can just some people would say, yeah, he debunked the claim because he said it's not magnetism, but the actual thing is still happening.
Yes.
There is an extraordinary thing happening. It turns out that these people have very sticky skin.
Yeah.
Very different power.
So it's basically like when I take a spoon and stick it on my nose and I just hang it there.
Yeah, but with their whole body.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they have
– they're just damp or like
– no.
they have a higher friction rate on their skin. So one of the things – one of the big clues that that's not really magnetism is first off, there's no detectable magnetic field. Mm-hmm. And secondly, although metal's the most popular thing that's – they stick to themselves, other things like glass, porcelain, wood, plastic – brass, these things also stick to them. So it's not, they're not walking refrigerators.
So could they pull some like sick Spider-Man type tricks?
You could get as close to Spider-Man as possible.
Spider-Man?
with someone
who displays
this. Yeah, I stole
that from Kristen and Caroline. They're always like, John Spider-Man, attorney at law.
So, this idea of, unusually frictive or sticky skin, it's interesting because I wonder if it would be possible to do what you're saying to increase the degree of stickiness such that these people would be able to support their own weight.
Mm.
And that's a really tall order. I mean, there are lizards that can do it, right? So why not people?
I say just add syrup.
That's your answer to everything.
Yeah, you got to – did what happened? Did Big Syrup get to you?
They really did. Yeah, yeah. I mean, what can I say, man? The maple – group. I don't know what they're called.
Yeah.
They don't have business cards or something.
You guys, we all went out for drinks a week or so ago, and Matt tried to order syrup.
Yep. They didn't have it.
He said syrup straight up.
Come on, the local.
But then there was that one time we were out and randomly these three Canadian dudes in suits with like black cases came up and took Matt aside, and I had a peek over it, and they had opened the case and there were these three perfect bottles of maple syrup and stuck in one of those like foam cutout things in the perfect shape.
Yep.
And then they were gone.
And they had these, little
maple leaf tattoos
right on their neck. You could just see.
Yeah. I had them design the containers to look just like the Secret of the Ooze. Things.
Oh yeah, mutagen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, also there are a lot of, it turns out there are real superpowers that are kind of like in the film Unbreakable. There are superpowers that are the opposite of a genetic weakness. So we know like color deficiency or color blindness. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that happens. Red-green color blindness is the most common. It's generally in men. And then, you know, there are less common ones relating to like yellow and blue or complete color blindness where everything is just a noir film for the rest of your life. And then there's someone on the other side. There are people called tetrachromats.
Whoa.
These people, who are overwhelmingly female, appear to literally see more colors than most of humanity ever will.
What does that mean, though? Are there more colors than what? Aren't there a finite number of colors? Maybe that, I don't know.
Well, they can differentiate, so it's probably something
shades.
Like, yeah, so yeah. Like what would be just regular old green to us is this vast panoply of strange visual delights. I don't know.
Well, according to, you know, my Photoshop color wheel and all the things that I ever deal with in color, there's what, about a million different shades and versions that I can see with my eye?
Mm-hmm. But tetrachromats can see up to what?
100 million. Which again, I don't know how you even get down that deep into the crevices
are
between
they just
the colors.
Like floating around in a psychedelic dream at all times.
I imagine that it's different.
But to them, it's probably normal. So, right? Most people have three cells or receptors in our retinas, but tetrachromats have a fourth receptor. And that may be what allows for their heightened color perception. It's also estimated that about 12% of women in the world carry the gene for this fourth receptor.
It makes me think of like certain really expensive cameras that have like bigger sensors or like, you know, more sensors or whatever.
Yeah.
You can just, you've got your equipment allows you to take in more information.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's
but what it means is the stuff is there. It's not like it's, we just can't see it, right?
Right. Exactly. So carrying the gene doesn't guarantee you'll wind up with supervision, but those who have the gene and who are immersed in a wide range of colors from a very young age appear more likely to develop it. Researchers are still trying to figure out what's going on with this. Still very early days in research here, so there aren't any hard numbers on how it manifests itself. However, it's a real thing, and if you are listening to this show, you may very well carry this gene.
Dude.
It's like my impulse is to be like, tell us what it's like.
Yeah.
It's sort of like asking a colorblind person to describe color, but like the opposite or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, it's tough.
It's like, it's just, you know, it's cool. It's just how I, it's just, you know, my day to day.
Yeah, it's my day to day. I don't know what you think blue's like, it looks like. Yeah, there's another one though. This one is crazy. This is perhaps one of the most comic book style powers.
Super strength.
That's right. Genuine super strength.
Why are you waving your fists at us, man?
Because I have it.
Oh, but it's linked to his aggression.
I like see.
Okay. That's why you spend so much time being nice, right?
Yeah, I have to be nice.
Otherwise,
we wouldn't like Matt when he's angry.
So we hear about cases of hysterical strength so often, right? A mother is lifting a car to rescue a kid, and someone's like, hey, average person, average mom person, you can't lift that Corolla.
I just did.
Oh, yeah. And this evidence is almost always anecdotal, right?
Because
it'd be really tough to create an experiment where we just scare people and see if they can lift cars.
Well, yeah. And it could – a lot of times it's not as extreme as lifting an entire car, but something that you shouldn't be able to do physically.
Right. There's a pretty good example or there's a pretty good theory, I should say, about how hysterical strength could work. And it all goes back to adrenaline. When Adrenaline's released by your adrenal medulla, and that's a interior region of your adrenal glands. It allows blood to flow more easily to your muscles, which means more oxygen goes to your muscles, which means your muscles function at elevated levels, right? Mm-hmm. And then when they are okay, so when you are throwing a punch or lifting a Toyota Corolla to save your kid or whatever, or just lifting things normally, your skeletal muscles, the ones that are attached to your bones, are activated by impulses from the nervous system. They contract, they tighten, and adrenaline facilitates the conversion of your body's fuel, glycogen, into its the fuel source into the actual fuel.
Yes.
Glycogen to glucose. So this gives extra energy to your muscles. A sudden burst of glucose also allows them to strengthen further for a very short time.
Yeah, and it also dampens your pain receptors a bit. So when you are, like, let's say in an adrenaline rage and lifting something, you don't feel your muscles maybe somewhat breaking in that moment.
Yeah, maybe you'll pay for it later.
Yeah.
But that's only temporary super strength. It turns out that the truth is stranger than the fiction in this case. There really is full-time, permanent, for the rest of your life, super strength.
So at 5 months old, this fellow from Grand Rapids, Michigan, named Liam Hoekstra, I think I'm pronouncing that right, started doing an expert gymnast move called the Iron Cross. And then by 8 months old, Liam could do a pull-up. And by 9 months, he could climb up and down stairs. I am 34, and I still cannot do a pull-up. So that is pretty cool. So soon the family thought, what's going on here? Like, they figured they should get it checked out. So they took him to a specialist who diagnosed Liam with a rare condition that's loosely called myostatin-related muscle hypertrophy. And that's according to a report by the Associated Press. And then virtually every animal on Earth has a gene that produces a muscle-grown inhibiting protein called myostatin. And high levels of myostatin make it hard for the body to build muscle, and low levels allow muscles to grow. So what's the takeaway here, Ben?
Oh, so that means that the gene responsible for myostatin, if it's broken, then there's no limiting of your muscle development.
Uninhibited.
Just keeps going.
Beefiness.
So it's not a gene that is supposed to give you super strength. It's a gene that's supposed to prevent you from having super strength. And when it's broken, you get more muscle, essentially. So
you may have seen this before, too, in cattle?
Yeah, there's a breed of cattle called the Belgian Blue that all of them just look ripped.
Crazy.
They look like I don't know how you would convince them to go to a slaughterhouse, you know?
Nope.
They look like they could just stare you down.
Do you think they're delicious? Or are they just too gamey? Probably too gamey.
I don't know. They might not have marbling, you know, with like the little strands of fat in there. Wagyu they are not. But it's also – this gene has also been found in mice. There was another kid in Germany who was detected with this ability earlier. The condition is so rare, only a few other cases have ever been found. So there's not secretly some community of superpowered tank people.
Yeah, just, you know, and Brock Lesnar, I guess.
Yeah, yet at least. Well, there's also so just a laundry list, a couple more here. There's also synesthesia, right, which we mentioned earlier. That is where your sensory inputs for one sense get cross-wired, or, you know, they get somehow combined with a another sensory input. So
haven't you experienced that before?
Yeah. Yeah. So, for like in, my case, a lot of, textures have colors and kind of shapes of their own.
Wow.
And in other cases, Vladimir Nabokov, is a phenomenal writer who also had synesthesia, and his wife had synesthesia, and I think one of his kids had synesthesia, and he attempted to prove, for him, letters had colors and shapes and – or colors and textures. And he attempted to prove that they were somehow accessing this greater truth.
Ooh.
But it turns out that his wife and his kid were both like, No, dude. O is not a blue, silver, oval.
Oh, they saw it in different
Yeah, they're things. Like, O is yellow. Why are you being an idiot?
Whoa.
So this seems to be individual, but it is a legitimate cross-century thing. And a lot of times people have probably experienced it in childhood maybe or in other – maybe under the influence of a psychotropic
Especially with
substance.
Music.
Or with music.
Well, it's a thing that comes up often with musicians and artists, in fact. Mental Floss has an article – called 12 Famous Artists with Synesthesia. So I'm just going to rip this one real quick just for your information. Uh-huh. We've got Nabokov, who wrote Lolita, a very well-known author. Tori Amos, who I was completely obsessed with when I was a kid. Huh. We've got Jeffrey Rush, the famous actor from Shine. It's a great film. Mm-hmm. Not so great from the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. We've got Duke Ellington, who is a fantastic band leader and musician and arranger and composer. Billy Joel, who'd have thunk it. We've got Dev Hynes from he's in a band called Blood Orange that's really, really cool. If you guys haven't heard them, recommend that. And he has something called chromesthesia, which is where you see sound as color.
Wow.
And you interpret sound as visually.
Very, very cool. And then rounded out, we have Ben Bullen of How Stuff Works and Stuff They Don't Want You to Know / Car Stuff / Brain Stuff.
What are you talking?
Synesthesia artists.
That's very kind. We do have a Brainstuff video about synesthesia.
There you go.
If someone's interested in learning it. But it's a real thing. Another cool thing you can do that's, I wonder, should we do synesthesia? An episode just on synesthesia?
We should. Looking back at this article, most of these artists had chromesthesia. I could see that when you're a musician, that kind of would be an interesting thing where you experience sound visually. I could see that as being kind of would be maddening at times, but I could see it as being like a whole headspace to be in for like getting there creatively.
It would predispose you to pursue music, I think. And then also, if some people's voices might just be ugly to you.
Yeah.
So you might not be able to talk to certain people.
Yeah, it's like, do you chase the good notes because they're the colors that are most appealing
totally.
To you?
It enhances the muse thing, but then I think you're right, Ben. It also enhances whatever the dark side of it is.
Ooh. Literally be like, please stop talking. Please.
Oh, please. Your ugly, ugly voice is blinding me. There's also, this will be one of the last ones for this purpose.
This is the closest thing, I think, to a true, true superpower that's in this list.
More so than super strength?
Yes.
Temperature control?
Yes.
Really?
As a survival mechanism, I think so.
So, yeah.
Wasn't Houdini able to do this? Did I make that up?
I wouldn't be surprised if he was. I haven't confirmed that, but it is possible for people to learn to control their the autopilot functions that your body usually has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are probably not many people who can or would purposefully stop their hearts unaided through meditation alone, but there are people who are able to raise or lower their functioning body temperature. Buddhist monks do this. You can see multiple video studies where they're in a cold room with an ice blanket placed over them and they just steam it off.
Yeah, dude.
Through a practice called Tummo, I want to say.
Yeah, Tummo. Essentially through meditation, just centering. Mm-hmm. So, like, getting so focused on it.
I was totally wrong about Houdini, by the way. Just putting that out there.
Oh, okay.
Or maybe he just didn't tell anybody.
See?
Yeah, that's it.
But there's a European named Wim Hof who learned these techniques and applied his own interpretation of them. And now he holds 26 world records because he has a superhuman ability to withstand extreme cold. And he says that through breathing exercises, he turns up his inner thermostat. He is able to climb up places like Everest just wearing shorts and shoes. Everest is very cold if you're familiar with it.
He's known as the Iceman.
Yeah, in a burst of creativity. He calls himself the Iceman. But you can see his numerous world records in this. I don't know. What's your favorite power so far, you guys, of the ones on the list?
I honestly think this is mine because one of the longest things humans have had to fight against is the winter and the cold and being able to you know, I don't know how long he can withstand it. It seems like a long period of time if he can get up Kilimanjaro using these techniques and staying warm. Swimming, I saw a video of him swimming just in the ice water. And he's just like, yeah, it's all good.
All right, so Matt, going for temperature control.
Honestly.
Matt the Hothead Frederick.
I just think it's the best.
More so than super strength?
Yeah, because muscles, you know, they're fine.
They're kind of gross.
What about you? I could see you as a synesthesia fan.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know whether it would be cool or not.
No refunds.
Without experience. It might be, you know, it might be like a double-edged sword, right? Mm-hmm. Like where it's like, okay, I'm this like genius composer, but I wish it would stop. You know, I don't know. It seems interesting. I don't know, man. Like, I think I'm with Matt on the body temperature one. That certainly is a functional.
All right. I'm switching mine then. I'm going to syrup skin. That's my favorite.
Oh boy.
Is that what we're dubbing that?
Syrup skin?
Yeah. Sticky Matt?
Sticky bod?
Yep. Sticky Matt?
Sticky bod crane?
Let's do it.
Oh, man.
I don't have to really wear clothes. I can just get objects and apply them to myself in various strategic places.
And whenever you need clothes, you'll just roll around on something?
Yeah, we're good to go.
Well, in case you don't, I don't want you to feel like you have to give your final answer now
because
there are a few more things and some interesting developments in the near future, which we'll learn about after a word from our sponsor. And we're back. So far, our journey into the world of extraordinary superpowers or semi-supernatural seeming abilities has been pretty fun, you know, kind of lighthearted. Mm-hmm. We haven't run into any real danger here.
No, and it's all – well, mostly it's been natural abilities that have been found in people, right?
Yeah. And it shows us a little bit about the scale and the scope of the human genome, right? Mm-hmm. We still have no idea what other stuff could be out there, but – this show being the type of show it is, of course, we do have a turn. There is some stuff they don't want you to know. And they, in this case, are various organizations that we mentioned in the top. The big question here is, what if someone decided to stop waiting on the genetic lottery, the infinite monkeys and infinite typewriters just sort of plucking away till they make poetry and Shakespeare? What if someone decided to stop waiting for accidents and started creating superpowers in humans?
Through technology, you mean?
Yes, through technology and a possible lack of ethics, right?
Yeah, human experimentation and then possibly covering it up.
Right. We've talked about DARPA projects in the past, including transcranial direct current simulation, alteration of sleep patterns, and a couple of other things, biofeedback experiments, creating cybernetic implants or the exploration of quote-unquote wetware, stuff like that. It's possible, but that's something that most people know about and that or most people are somewhat aware of and doesn't seem too terrible, right?
Yes.
But there's something else there. It turns out that there are prevalent worries that private entities may be attempting to control genes, certain genetic expressions, one of which would be, for instance, an immunity to pain.
Yeah, this is – I'm going to use it, Noel. This is fascinating. I saw a video on YouTube not too long ago about a gentleman who has this genetic condition, and it has upsides and downsides to it, it appears. The big upside is that you can't feel pain, or you feel pain to a much lesser degree than any normal person walking around would.
So you could perhaps persist – long after – at an activity long after a pain threshold would have been reached by another person.
Yeah, because pain is really just your body telling you, hey, don't do this or get away from there or, you know, there's danger right now.
Yeah.
I have a friend who I grew up with who had a condition called spina bifida or has, and he couldn't feel had some extremities that he had no feeling in. Mm. And so what ended up happening sometimes was he would get – a cut or something like that, mm-hmm. and he wouldn't notice it. And over time, if he didn't pay attention to it, it could be problematic, right?
Oh, yeah, get infected.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, you think the idea of not feeling pain is super cool, but it could be a liability too, right?
No, mm-hmm. pain is a survival mechanism.
Yeah.
We would probably not be here if we could not have something to tell us that fire is hot.
Yeah, exactly. And in this case, we're dealing with a mutation in the gene LRP5. If you're writing these down, make sure you're keeping track. There will be a quiz at the end on the genes.
It's not true.
Oh, no? I thought we were doing a gene quiz.
It might be.
Okay.
You know, play it by ear.
Okay.
We don't want the rules of our show to be as rigid as the bones of this clan.
Oh.
I don't know if that was worth an O. That was worth a nod that we are keeping the conversation moving. Mm-hmm. So yes, it's absolutely true. This gene has been isolated. It has been found. We have traced the source of nigh unbreakable bones.
Mm-hmm.
There's another gene for a what's called a super sleeper mutation. Imagine if you could just sleep 4 hours a night for the rest of your life, and you would feel great. Better, in fact, than people who got their solid 8 to 10. There's a group of people. They're called short sleepers, and scientists are only recently uncovering what makes them this way. It turns out it's a gene called HDEC2. For the most part, researchers believe these are connected to specific genetic mutations, and the one that we just shouted out, HDEC2, is only one of the genes that they have gone public with. Mm. So there are other ones that are currently classified research. And just like we mentioned with tetrachromats, there are also super tasters.
Man, I was just about to plug our buddies Will and Mangesh from Part Time Genius. They have an episode on sleep where they talk about Margaret Thatcher and her, you know, infamous ability to sleep very, very little. But there was another episode they did where Jerry, our mysterious boss and producer of Stuff You Should Know, and myself joined Will and Mango in the studio to take a test to see if we were super tasters. And
whoa.
It involved putting this little piece of paper in our mouths. And if you were a super taster, it would taste really bitter. And if you weren't, it would just taste like nothing. And Jerry's a super taster. Y'all.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it tasted really bitter.
Wow.
Well,
so we have a super powered individual in our midst.
Did they tell you it was supposed to be bitter before the test?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See, now they shouldn't have done that. They should have given you the...
No. I wanted it. I mean, the way that she described it was like, whoa, like big time. Like I, in my mind was like, maybe it's a little bitter.
Yeah.
That was my placebo effect kicking in. But for her, she was like, you guys, this tastes like grapefruit. Like, you know, like, yeah, like big time.
Here's another genetic, predisposition that may be a world changer, and let's hope that the right researchers get a hold of it or allowed to work with it. Cancer immunity. In Ecuador, there was a group of people who are called the Laron dwarves.
Whoa.
L-A-R-O-N. They appear, according to all the researchers, to be immune to cancer,
wow.
diabetes, and a couple of other diseases. The people who suffer this syndrome and also have this immunity have lack a hormone called IGF-1. And scientists are hoping that they can develop a drug that will mimic the good parts of this genetic defect. And the people who inherit the defect are in perfect human proportions. However, they only grow to an average height of 4 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And there are about 300 people in the world who have this condition, which is known as Laron dwarfism. And a third of them live in remote villages in Ecuador's southern Loja province.
Wow. So in this case, IGF-1 is this blessing and a curse, because it seems like the lack of it is what causes the growth, like, or the lack of growth in height. But it's also the thing that's preventing them from getting these terrible diseases, not having it.
Yeah, IGF stands for insulin-like growth factor 1, and it's This is the stuff that simulates a cell to grow and divide. If you're an ordinary person, you have too much of this hormone, you can develop prostate, breast, or bowel cancer early in your childhood.
Jeez.
So it's a good question. You know, what would you do to prevent somebody from, like, your child from getting cancer?
Yeah, I know. Like, what consequences would you take?
Right. Also, what would you do if you were a private corporation, a pharmaceutical or something, to control access to this? The privatization and for-profit deployment of genetic therapy is a huge concern, and it may be very, very big news in the next few years. Have you heard of something called gene doping?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, it's basically a hypothetical non-therapeutic use of gene therapy by athletes. And the purpose is to gain the upper hand over their opponents in terms of their performance in particular sporting events, most of which, all of which, I would say, prohibit such applications of genetic modification. I mean, it's essentially – they call it doping because the doping is referring to taking performance enhancing drugs. This is just kind of a cooler, sciencier, you know, version of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as of April 2015 at least, there's no hard evidence that gene doping has been used for performance enhancement yet. But that data is from 2 years ago.
Mm.
More than 2 years ago now. So what else could have happened?
Well, do you think it'd be harder or easier to detect even? Like, how would you even, like, screen for it in the way that you would, like, with a blood or a urine test for, you know, steroids or human growth hormone or something?
That's
like
true.
That?
And I also wonder, when it comes to this expression, how one would do it in an adult person. You know what I mean? Because for me, I'd always thought of genetic modification as something that occurs in utero.
Yeah, early on before you become a human.
Right. We had talked about this, I think, over drinks one night with my roommate Frank, where we, you know, there was a thing I read where researchers were able to encode a GIF of a galloping horse
into
a sequence of DNA.
Yeah.
And what resulted from that was this notion that we can theoretically store electronic information in our gene.
Yeah,
our
vast genes. Amounts. Yeah.
Right. But how do you do that? How do you add it in? And the thing that we came up with was, well, maybe you have to inject it into your stem cells and then it propagates throughout your entire code.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know. Scientists, lab rats, reach out.
Help.
Talk to us.
I really appreciate you bringing up that conversation because that is all true and it is phenomenal. This is what a time to be alive type stuff. Gene doping would involve the use of gene transfer to increase or decrease expression and biosynthesis of specific proteins. According to the latest theories, this could be done by directly injecting a gene carrier into a person or by taking cells from a person, transforming those cells, and then sending them back to the person.
Wow.
So there would be like no potential for rejection or something if it were a foreign cell. We have some examples of this too, and we'll group them by how they might affect performance. So first there would be the skeletal enhancement. Alpha actinin 3 is found only in skeletal muscles in humans, and it has a different, what's called polymorphism in world-class athletes in comparison to normal people. So one form causes the gene to make protein, and it's found in sprinters, and it's related to increased power. And there's another form that causes the gene to make less protein, and it's found in endurance athletes. So we could say, you know, we're going to make Tristan McNeil a world-class sprinter, so let's inject him with this form.
Have you seen the boy run? He's good.
He's a gazelle.
Yeah, he is.
He's like a cheetah mixed with a gazelle.
The grace.
Yeah.
Just springing across the tundra.
There's this sly.
The savannah.
Yeah.
Wherever gazelles spring.
He's svelte.
He's like smiling and nodding.
Oh,
yeah. But it's like a mischievous smile.
Yeah, it's very much like a Michael Douglas and Falling Down smile.
What I found out today, a mutual coworker of ours, don't have to go too off track.
Yeah, yeah.
Father-in-law, old buddies with Michael Douglas.
Whoa.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's
our boy N-Dog. Leave it at that.
Oh, okay.
He got to go to the Ant-Man set and watch the part where he was filming the part where he looks young.
Yeah.
And like he said, they shot it with him and then with a younger actor that looked a lot like him. And they did the exact same moves and they somehow like comped them together, like with the body or whatever to like, I don't know exactly. I'm, you know, there's the movie stuff these days.
Yeah.
That's going over my head. That's what that sound is. But anyway, let's go back to regular topic.
Ant-Man powers would also be fantastic.
Oh, that's, good look at you.
They're technologically driven, you know. I think in the comics there's a temporary time where for some reason he finds out he's been exposed to Pym particles so much that he can just change without the suit. But let's be realistic in our comic books. God.
You know what a good drink is underrated? What's Pym's cup.
A Pym's cup? I've never had one because of my aversion to touching metal.
Refreshing. What? No, why do you have to? You know,
don't they have to come in a metal cup?
No, I don't think so. They just give a Moscow Mule.
That's a Moscow Mule.
Yeah.
Another thing I will never drink. Imagine. That's pretty crazy to increase that running power in one of two ways.
Or what if you do it in both ways?
You mean just switch it back and forth?
Yeah, whenever you wanted to.
There might be consequences. So just shoot yourself in the thigh or the base of your spine when it's time for a sprint at the end of your marathon?
Yeah, man.
Couldn't there just be like a capsule you bite down on?
Sure.
Yeah. I like this idea.
Anything you want, guys.
Thanks, Matt. There's also, we mentioned myostatin deficiency. That would enhance your musculature. There's a specific kind of glycoprotein that can act as a hormone controlling your red blood cell production. And this glycoprotein, specifically erythropoietin or EPO, has already been injected as a performance-enhancing substance for many years. What it does is since it increases the production of red blood cells – it means that you get more oxygen available to your muscles, which means that you experience fatigue in a different way. Your endurance is getting pumped up.
Jeez.
Well, we do want to pump.
Pump it up.
Oh, jeez.
You up.
Here's a scary one. There are proteins that could affect not just your physical attributes, but your mental attributes. So imagine gene doping that affects your psychology, pain perception, right? Someone is a rugby player. I'm like, I don't want to feel any pain when I'm rugbying.
Yeah, you'd be a super rugber.
Or perhaps a cricket player wielding a wicket.
You could dual wield wickets, maybe.
The bats.
That's not regulation.
You can't dual wield the wickets. All right.
Well, I was just hoping.
I learned about cricket recently for a work thing, but I'm probably never going to be a world-class cricket player unless I dope myself up with all four of those things we mentioned before.
Just like a fistful of needles.
Bam! Yeah, and if I survive the stabs, then I'm going to take over the world of cricket. The point of this, and we do hope you've enjoyed the episode so far, is that as fantastic and fictional and sci-fi-esque as these may seem, there are not only genuine extraordinary human abilities, but there are groups that are working to further these abilities, to turn them into a profitable enterprise. And look, we're not automatically saying that's bad. I do think personally that it's dangerous, but that's my opinion. But then we ask the question, you know, what if the profit motive is the only way these things become available, right? What if there's it's sort of weird because I don't want to paint a false dichotomy, but who would you rather be the person controlling genetic super strength? Would it be a military that is making soldiers? Would it be, you know, Pfizer or something?
It's like with the military, like a lot of that happens behind closed doors and relatively low oversight from the public. I mean, if any at all, right?
Yeah, you're talking black budget stuff there.
Totally. It's like the thing in the Wolverine movie, the really depressing
Logan?
One. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to give anything away, but that's definitely a
theme.
A big theme in it, specifically, you know, with kids.
Yeah.
And it's the way they portray it. It is super dark and super like, wow, we really let this thing get out of hand and now it's coming back to haunt us kind of thing, you know. But yeah, there's a lot of ethical questions involved in this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But like you're saying, I guess with a company like Pfizer, at least there's this sense of oversight, but it's so gray. And
And it's dangerous too. You know, it's like the argument we hear a lot in various correspondences on the internet. You know, a lot of folks tell us in reference to pharmaceutical companies that these companies are not seeking a cure. Why would they put themselves out of business? They're instead building a service model based on making somebody take a regimen of pills on a regular basis for the rest of their life.
I think that's spot on.
And if that pill can make you need to take another pill because of side effects, then all the we'll better sell you for the that bottom pill line. Too. Yeah.
So this is that's something we should also explore. Yeah, it seems like you're pretty convinced it's true. Huh?
I mean, I don't know exactly to what extent, but it certainly seems like cure research has to be much more like privately funded, and it's a lot harder to get that kind of research funded than it is to get funding for something that's like a sure thing that we know will make money.
Yeah, that's a good point. There are a lot of diseases that persist because there's not a profit incentive to combat them, you know? But the research does continue, and for the record, malaria is dwindling now.
Mm-hmm. So, well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Just for the record, I can't imagine large governments, especially those with armies that heavily rely on skilled human beings.
Yeah.
I don't see why any one of those would not be at least trying some kind of genetic enhancement research.
Oh. Also, I just remembered, we asked Matt to have a superhero alias, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the closest we came organically was Sticky Matt.
That was close.
I don't know if you want to be Sticky Matt.
I think Syrup Skin works or Syrup the Syrup Snake.
The Syrup Snake?
How about the Syrupy Snake?
Yeah,
Syrupy
Snake. That's pretty good, the Syrupy Snake. So.
Blip versus the Syrupy Snake.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, we'd be – oh, that does sound kind of evil if you're the snake.
Yeah. Yeah, the Syrup Snake.
Do you hiss?
How about –
do you spit maple syrup like
I
venom?
I do. Yeah.
Or you could be –
but it just gets you real sticky.
Yeah, that's – and it makes you like me.
You immobilize people. Yeah. You could also be like the syrup ferret. That's also sort of serpentine but less –
okay.
Well, if Zippy Tristan over here was running after you, you could spit – maple syrup on his feet and slow him down.
There we go. Mm. Yeah. Okay. So you're the speedster. You can teleport. I'm pointing at people now.
Yeah.
Sorry. I just realized I forgot that they can't
you're
see this point.
You're the shadow demon.
I'm fine with that. Look, I think shadow powers is creative. I was going for creativity.
Just throwing this in there. Shadow demon, I believe, is a 5/6 flyer for 6 mana.
Is this a magic reference?
Yeah.
Is that good? Is any of what you said good? Is that
nerd alert?
Well, if it's good, then that's fine. I'll be a shadow demon.
Perfect.
All right. Well, I wish it was a better name, but we hope you enjoyed this episode, and it is time for
Shout Out Corners.
Our first shout out goes to Matt. Matt, listen to an episode that we just released around the times of our birthdays in August.
Mm.
And he says, I just listened to How May I Help You, the episode. And although the episode and acting inside was fantastic, how dare you leave your listeners hanging like that? Just kidding. LOL. I loved it. Even though I look forward to learning each week about all the topics you guys cover, this was a nice break. Incredibly entertaining and downright hilarious at times. Wow, thank you, Matt. That's very kind. I hope this will become a regular addition to the show. Keep up the great work, guys. And Matt says, P.S., yes, if the title didn't give it away, I am a Canadian. LOL. Oh, the title is, No, What the H.E. Double Hockey Sticks.
Well, first, thanks for writing. That was such a tremendous compliment. Noel and I were looking at each other waiting to see what the plot twist would be.
I know. The plot twist.
What was your dramatic reading?
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
The plot twist is that he hopes that it will become a regular addition to our show.
We have to give producer Alex some serious props for that one.
Yeah.
I don't think we gave him his due in the actual episode, because he not only did like the sound design and all the cool stuff, he like that song at the end, he
that's
wrote
him.
It like
that's
from
him.
Scratch.
And that's so Tarantino.
So cool.
Yeah.
And it even has lyrics that like match the theme of the episode. It's just great. If you guys haven't listened to that, that one or if you skipped over it because you were like, this is weird. It's, trust me, it's fun.
At least at the very end. Yeah.
The whole thing's a lot of fun.
Yeah. My only regret is that we didn't get to hear inside the episode how Tristan really feels about you, Ben. Because we got it on audio.
I guess we can play the outtake.
Okay, we'll do.
Thanks, Uncle Roy. Back to work then. Love you.
Love you too.
That's real.
So, got to do that. Come on. We got, that clip is too good. So,
I love you too.
It's so good. It's so good.
So we have rewrites. Thank you so much. We really enjoy doing this sort of stuff, and it's a treat for us as well. It does take a little bit more time, a lot of time in post-production to make it sound good.
So we were lucky enough to have a cool crew that was into, you know, doing it, and you surprised us with that. I don't know if we mentioned that either. You like had written this thing and surprised us with a fancy table read and all this stuff, and it came out really great. I'm pretty excited.
Well, here's to the next time. Stay tuned for All Hallows Eve, perhaps.
The next shout out is from Paul. He says, good day, gentlemen. Hope you are all well. I've been an avid listener for several years now and have really enjoyed listening to your interviews and analysis. I don't usually – this is me, Noel, talking. I don't usually read the accolades here, but I want to read it because it sets up what's to come. I can't speak highly enough of your podcast. I was therefore not very impressed with your recent podcast on Bigfoot. I've been a Bigfoot fan since as long as I can remember, so I couldn't wait to hear the podcast on the train on the way to work last week. I was therefore expecting some groundbreaking news, video, still pictures, but alas, absolutely nothing. I'm going to skip some of this stomping on our Bigfoot episode just to get to the part that I thought was actually an interesting commentary.
I think this whole email is interesting. I understand it is a little bit longer, and I do want to point out that I love that you said stomping on our Bigfoot episode.
Yes. Stomping on our Bigfoot episode.
I caught it too.
So I'm going to get to the part that I thought was most interesting, but alas, absolutely nothing. Then there was the issue of population. I believe the figure quoted was 30,000. But then later, David Bacara, our guest, went on to say that they were from another dimension. They can't be flesh and blood in one sentence and then invisible, interdimensional in the next. It's too confusing. I could be swayed one way or the other, but both? I could go on ranting and pointing out inconsistencies, but I'll stop here. And then he says, nothing against you guys, but you need to ask your guests some tougher questions. Otherwise, if we follow David Bacara's logic, we can blame everything, JFK, 9/11, UFO, Monsanto, New World Order, etc., on the magical elves. Keep up the good work and ask the hard questions. You never know. You might end up with an exclusive piece of evidence as opposed to blaming fairy folk. Best regards, Paul.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was as harsh but fair. In our defense, the fairy stuff and the interdimensional stuff was sort of a thought experiment. I mean, it was kind of like the way we approached it as far as the way I approached it was that's an interesting thing to think about. Why are they so elusive? Perhaps, and there's a lot of accounts of them shimmering out and, you know, doing these kind of like predator invisibility kind of stuff, right? I don't know. I never really said that I was fully on board with it, but I enjoy talking about this stuff, even if it's not like the most obvious solution. So that's what an interview is a lot of times, is kind of just going down rabbit holes with people. And I felt like we asked good questions and that we, you know, explored various aspects of the Bigfoot phenomenon.
Well, it's weird that interview we're going right up against one of the tenets of our show, which is not to tell anybody what to believe, right? And if we're going to go right ahead and say, hey, we don't believe you, David, or we don't believe this, I think that's doing a disservice to everybody listening.
So I do remember I felt we would be remiss if we didn't say, all right, if there's a creature this large, why aren't there any bodies? Why isn't there any fecal matter? You know, gorillas, other large primates often build nests. Where are the H-E double hockey sticks are those? And that was part of the question that prompted this proposition of some sort of extra dimensional entity, which is just not doing it for me. There's not a shred of corroborating evidence. Mm. But I will point out also that the person we interviewed, David Bacara, I believe, if I recall correctly, at some point he said he didn't want people to find Bigfoot.
That's what he said.
Isn't that the thing that he mentioned?
Oh, yeah.
So he has some – he does have some – I appreciate you pointing this out, Paul, because I clocked it too. He does have some seemingly self-contradicting theories about Bigfoot. And I think he's just going through and considering each of them out loud. But you know what? If it turns out that Bigfoot is some sort of extra-dimensional entity, I will apologize publicly. I will eat a hat. I will wear a stupid costume for a year in this dimension or the next. You know, it's the least I can do. I'd rather learn the truth than feel like I am always right. You know what I mean?
For sure.
But I will be really surprised. I'm just going to be really surprised. And if you guys have not checked out that interview yet, please do give it a listen. We found some really cool stuff, and the guy has an encyclopedic knowledge of Bigfoot encounter stories, you know? Mm-hmm. All right, we have one more shout out today. It is from Camilla. Camilla says, "Hey guys, I'm a little late to this, but I just discovered your podcast, so I've been listening to a lot of past episodes at work, but I think I have a good explanation for what a kitten whisper is. From my own personal experience with kittens."
Do we need a background check
who
here?
Who chose this?
Wasn't that in our drug episode or something where wasn't that like a slang for copping some kind of drug?
It was a large list. It was a huge list. And at the end, Kitten Whisperer was there. We decided that was our favorite.
Because when I first saw this email, I was like, does she mean Kitten Whisperer?
Yeah.
No,
Kitten Whisperer.
That sweet Kitten Whisperer.
Give me that sweet kitten. So I'm sorry, Ben. Carry on.
Thank you.
It's a deep cut.
Thank you. It was deeper than I had. I wasn't sure what a kitten whisper was as we were reading this. So Camilla is helping us out. She says, "I think I have a good explanation for what a kitten whisper is. From my own personal experience with kittens, I think a kitten whisper is when they sniff your ear and you can hear the little adorable sniffles. Thanks for keeping me entertained at work."
Okay.
Okay. So maybe not a drug?
Yeah, maybe it's just the little sniffles.
Or maybe it's opium.
Oh, okay.
So thank you so much, Camilla, Paul, and Matt. This concludes our...
If you want to be like Camilla, Paul, and Matt and write to us, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook where we're Conspiracy Stuff. You can check out some photos that we post and hang out with us on Instagram, Conspiracy Stuff Show. And we especially want to hear from you if you have any stories about superpowers in your families, genetics, perhaps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the business. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Anything you've encountered a bit strangely? Maybe you're a geneticist and you want to clarify some things with us.
Or you want to slap us around and call us a bunch of dummies.
That's okay. We accept and we want to learn from you. So if you don't want to reach out to us through those social media venues, you can write to us directly. We are
Conspiracy@HowStuffWorks.com.